members in attendance. First item of business is the approval of Secretary's Report Number 412 of April 18th, 2024. The report is available in the meeting's materials. Are there any corrections to the Secretary's report? Hearing none, the report is approved. Thank you. I'd now like to invite Senate Secretary Dr. Jared Gardner to say a few words, but before I do that, I want to welcome him to this new post. Ben Givens left some pretty big shoes to fill, but I know Jared's up to the task and he's already proven to be a phenomenal partner, so I look forward to our work together. Over to you, Jared.
Thank you so much, President Carter, and this is an incredible honor to be here working with the Senate for 24-25. As President Carter said, this is indeed a very big shoes to fill. I miss Ben regularly, as I know many of us who've worked with him in the past do. We're going to drag him back here to hang out with us and mentor me as soon as we can. I also want to introduce our new recording secretary. A few of you have, in fact, many of you have already interacted with her. It's Ivy Hammond, and she and I are here to help in any way we can with the work of the Senate committees, the work of the constituent groups, and of course, the work of the Senate as a whole. So call on our office anytime. We are truly always at your service. If you suspect there might be issues that arise after hours that you need more direct contact, I'm always happy to share myself. So I know we also have today, which is terrific, to interest in the work of the Senate is something we always strive for and eager to share what we do here with the larger community always. So just a couple of things, both for new senators and for visitors. This is kind of something for us all to kind of keep in mind as we head into the year's work. So the Senate is a deliberative assembly, and it's charged with making institutional decisions after its members have had the chance to address whatever is pending business. As many of you veteran senators know, the vast majority of a lot of the work of the Senate takes place in committees and makes its way here for final deliberation and vote when there are voting issues. Non-senators are, of course, always welcome to attend and observe, but non-senators do not have speaking privileges unless the Senate extends this privilege to them. That's just a kind of quick reminder, rules in place throughout our work during the course of the year. And again, for those who are visitors, ever have any questions about how we do things in Senate or some of the background on any issues we discuss, I'm always happy to either answer if I can or point you in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. I am thrilled to welcome this body to another academic year at Ohio State. I'm also thrilled to be back here with all of you to continue supporting the important teaching, learning, scholarship, and service our university is known for. I also want to touch on the two recent incidents of gun violence on and near the university's Columbus campus. Safety remains my top priority. I've said that since the first day I was announced. And these recent incidents are extremely concerning. I've been in touch with the mayor's office today, and I've been assured of the city's continued emphasis on safety in the neighborhoods around our campus. The Ohio State University Police and the Columbus Police are working closely together, and they will have a highly visible presence on and near campus. They'll also continue their targeted efforts to reduce crime. As I've said before, we're located in the middle of one of the largest cities in the United States, and unfortunately, crime is going to happen. Even so, we are committed to doing everything we can to promote safety on our campuses and to equip Buckeyes with knowledge and tools to enhance their safety off campus, as well as work with our partners at the city to reduce and prevent crime. This is a responsibility we take seriously and one we will always be focused on. Now, a couple of updates. Even as we face these issues, the Ohio State community does have a lot to be proud of. You may have read that we welcomed to the Columbus campus the largest class of incoming students in Ohio State's 154-year history. More than 9,500 new Buckeyes join us, and like the classes before them, they are exceptionally talented. Enrollment across the university is up by 2.3% compared to last year, and the combined enrollment of our regional campuses and at Ohio State ATI has grown by almost 20% since 2022. Our commitment to our home state remains strong. More than 71% of our students are from right here in our state of Ohio. Strong numbers like these show that people continue to believe in the value of an Ohio State degree. It's a value we're committed to enhancing going forward. In the research and innovation space, we learned that the Worcester campus of our College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences will be home to the new TARDIS Engineering Research Center. It will be funded with a 5-year, $26 million award from the National Science Foundation. It's going to help researchers at Ohio State and across the country revolutionize domestic rubber production by harnessing the power of nature and our expertise in engineering, biology, and agriculture. Several important searches for open leadership positions at the university are underway. These include deans for the College of Business, College of Public Health, and Ohio State Marion. We're also getting close in our search for a new provost. I don't have to tell any of you how critical these positions are to the university, and we are determined to find the right people to fill them. As many of you also know, we launched a new initiative called Listen, Learn, Discuss. This is a centralized set of tools to help all of us develop skills to engage in respectful dialogue and to give us opportunities to practice those skills. This was developed with the input of our students, faculty, and staff, and our goal with it is to foster an environment of trust on our campuses. Buckeyes come to our campuses with a wide range of backgrounds, experiences, and viewpoints, and being able to have dialogue with each other and to learn from our different perspectives is an important part of how we deepen our understanding of the world. The ability to have tough conversations with respect and compassion is especially important right now. There's a lot going on in the world, including an election coming up in just 2 months, and there are strong feelings surrounding that and other events. So disagreeing respectfully and following the rules, standards, and laws that protect each and every one of us is critical, not only to making sure we can do the work we came here to do, but also to make sure that we live up to our motto, education for citizenship. We're going to have a discussion later today about what that motto means and what it looks like, and I'm very excited to hear it. In addition to being a call to civic engagement and civil discourse, I've learned over the past 8 months that education for citizenship is also a call to continually improve, to evolve, to meet the changing needs of those we serve. As I've said here before, I've been listening and learning since my very first day as a Buckeye. And through all the listening sessions I've been a part of, all of the conversations I've had, the faculty and staff survey we sent out in May, our vision for where this university ought to go over the next decade is starting to come into focus. Starting this September and running through the end of October, we're holding a series of workshops to refine that vision and the strategic framework for how we're going to achieve it. We've already held more than a dozen of these workshops. Many of you have been part of these. I want to thank the Faculty Council, the USAC leadership, and our student government leadership for your time and ideas. We've had some amazing conversations, and they're going to help us make this plan better. So during my investiture on November 8th, I will be excited to share the outcome of your work, a vision and strategic framework that reflect the aspirations of our entire university community. I'll also be asking many more of you to contribute your insights and expertise as we bring the plan to life and ultimately launch it in July of this next year. As I said in April during my first State of the University address, and as I shared my messages to Buckeyes last week, where Ohio State goes in the future will be up to the entire Ohio State community. It's been a tremendous privilege to learn from and work with all of you so far. I'm excited to continue that in the months ahead as we finish work on a strategic vision and framework in the years to come as we continue to grow our impact for Ohioans and for each and every person we serve. So again, thank you all for your work. Let's have a great semester. Continuing on, let's do some constituent leader introductions. The next item on our agenda is the introduction of the 2024-2025 Senate constituent leaders. These are the individuals who represent bodies that make up our Senate as a whole. a structure that is relatively unique among institutions in higher education. I'll ask each of you to stand as you're recognized. First, Bobby McAlpine, President, Undergraduate Student Government. Justin Robinson, Vice President, Undergraduate Student Government. Sabrina Durso, President, Council of Graduate Students. Tyson Montgomery, President, Interprofessional Council.
He'll be here next time.
How about Tracy Boggs, the Chair of University Staff Advisory Council?
She'll be here next time.
Allison Gawham, Chair-elect University Staff Advisory Council. Sarah Watson, Chair, Faculty Council. And Valerie Williams, Chair-elect, Faculty Council. Thank you to all of you for the work you do. We're excited to work with all of you this academic year. Okay, next up is a proposal from the Council on Academic Affairs. Dr. Sue Sutherland, Chair of the Council, will present.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sue Sutherland. I'm chairing the Council of Academic Affairs this academic year. I'm here to present the proposal to establish a professional Master of Cybersecurity and Digital Trust degree from the College of Engineering. The goal of the Master of Cybersecurity and Digital Trust degree, program is to supply highly skilled individuals to the cybersecurity workforce in Ohio and the nation, focusing on imparting cybersecurity knowledge and skill sets relevant to existing and emerging positions in the workforce. It's been determined that a market for such a program exists, and there are no competing programs of this type in the state. Graduates will be trained by experts at the university as well as industry partners. The two primary targeted audiences for the program are students who recently received their Bachelor of Science degree in a field related to computer science, cybersecurity, electrical or computer engineering, or information technology, or students with bachelor's degrees in non-traditional backgrounds and degrees if they provide evidence of in-workforce experience and/or training in relevant topics. The program will be 30 semester hours. It will have two tracks focusing on design and implementation, and offense and defense, and include a mandatory project-oriented course. It will be offered fully online, can be completed in two semesters, and is expected to admit one cohort of 50 students both in the autumn and spring semesters. The expected learning outcomes have been specified, and there's an active self-assessment process. It's anticipated that 10 faculty members will be involved with the program and no new faculty lines will be needed to maintain it. The proposal has the support of the College of Engineering and the Departments of Electrical and Computer Engineering, Computer Science and Engineering, and Industrial and Systems Engineering, and will be offered in partnership with the Institute of Cyber Security and Digital Trust and the College of Engineering's Professional and Distance Education Program. The proposal was reviewed by the Joint Subcommittee of the Graduate School and Council on Academic Affairs, and then approved by the full Council on Academic Affairs at its meeting on June 14, 2024. And Julia Armstrong is here from the College of Engineering if you have any specific questions.
This proposal comes from a standing committee of the Senate and therefore does not require a motion or second. So the resolution is open for discussion. Dr. Caroline Clark will help manage questions posed online and in person.
Thank you. You said there was no competing program in the state of Ohio. I was wondering if you could set the landscape in terms of there are similar programs across the nation.
Julia, is Julia here?
Yes.
Okay, I defer to you.
Thank you.
I will say first off that the market data is a few years old, and we have currently reviewed some of this. A key component is the online component of this master's program, that it's fully online. Franklin University does offer something similar, but it is more for the IT practitioner versus the core engineering technologies.
Any other questions, comments? Okay, hearing none, seeing none, please indicate your vote on the Carmen site. Resolution passes. Next on the agenda is a proposal from the Rules Committee. Dr. Susan Gershman, Chair of the Rules Committee, will present. Susan.
So the proposed change just involves the one place in the rules in which faculty cabinet is referred to. And so that is in the Grad Council membership language. And so we're just proposing to change the wording back from faculty cabinet to Senate cabinet. And this has already been brought before the Faculty Council last term.
Okay, the committee resolution is now open for discussion. Any questions or comments in person or online?
We have a
request from a non-Senate person to make a comment. Is there anybody opposed to that?
Thanks for the permission to speak. Pranav Jani, I should introduce myself. I thought that the change makes sense with the change from faculty Senate to university Senate, but I thought it was really interesting that it happened in 1972, after the huge protests on the Oval. And I'm wondering if you have any knowledge about whether those protests have anything to do with that change, or if there's any history that we can learn more about.
I put this resolution forward, and the primary reason for making this resolution, I'm chair of steering and also chair of cabinet. Those are the two spaces within which we talk about committees. Because we have students and staff on those committees, not strictly faculty, we decided it made more sense to call it a Senate cabinet than a faculty cabinet.
To give a quick answer, Pranav, to your question about the name, the change of this body in 72 from faculty to university senate, That was actually grew out of demands from students in really beginning around 66 for more participation and direct engagement with the work of the Senate, which had previously been a faculty-only Senate. It was a six-year process, lots of debates and discussions, but eventually ended up with a body that actually the constituent members, aside from the welcome and long overdue addition of staff senators, the overall makeup of the Senate has remained intact since then.
Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, seeing none, please indicate your vote on the Carmen site. Resolution passes. Next will be two moderated discussions. First focuses on student life at Ohio State, including the size of our recent first year class and discussion on loneliness among students across our campuses. Dr. Melissa Shiver, Senior Vice President for Student Life, and Dr. Mickey Sharma, Director of the Counseling and Consultation Service, will present.
Is it not shared? Can you see it?
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. That makes me feel so much better. For those of you who have not had the opportunity to meet, my name is Melissa Shivers, and I have the distinct pleasure of serving as our Senior Vice President for Student Life here at Ohio State. One of the things that brings me the most joy is the opportunity to be able to connect and partner with colleagues both across the university, but more centered around those that are looking at and thinking about the student experience all the time. So I'm very fortunate today to be joined by Dr. Sharma and also Bobby McAlpine as we think about these important topics of ways to enhance the student experience. President Carter mentioned the fact that we are welcoming one of the largest classes, or the largest class, at The Ohio State University. And it has been a wonderful journey to get to this place. I want to acknowledge the Housing and Residence Life Education team who did so much incredible work to prepare our residence halls, so our facilities teams, our dining teams, everyone to help create a positive and welcoming environment for our first year students and certainly for those that returned to Ohio State. We recognize that more people creates more opportunity, but I do feel like if there's any place in the country that can manage that, that is Ohio State. So very grateful for the opportunity to serve so many students and families this year, and looking forward also to a really good year. But today, we want to talk a little bit about some of the data and what we learned about our students and, in many cases, our staff experiences at Ohio State. I would offer that a lot of probably what I'm going to share may sound very warm and fuzzy. And then there are other portions, I hope, that you all will join us in a conversation in just a few minutes to think together about how do we try and attempt to address these issues around loneliness and connection on our campus. I will tell you that we have had a lot of opportunities to think about ways to make sure that students are having a positive experience. We have tons of student organizations. We have opportunities for students to find their passion and to dig deep and find and build relationships inside and outside of the residence halls. Yet what we also know is that during the pandemic, there were complete barriers really put in place that limited our opportunities for engagement. We wore masks, we were told to be physically distanced from people, and so it took a while, I think, for people to start to really turn around from that and get back to what we would perceive or say is now is normal behavior. Yet what I want to offer today is that that turn didn't happen as easily for many of our students, faculty, and staff here at Ohio State. I want to talk a little bit about some of the data that we have received from the research from the Gallup poll shows that it's really important that people have relationships and connections. In the Office of Student Life, we have four culture commitments: appreciation, connection, care, and support. And today, we want to spend a little bit of time talking about the importance of connection. The Gallup poll tells us that connections are critical in driving employee engagement, which leads to a feeling and a sense of purpose and meaning in our work, motivation to do a really good job, and also being invested in the success of the organization. Gallup has long contended that having a best friend at work is integral to overall employee engagement and satisfaction. They say employees who have a friend at work are 7 times more likely to be engaged in their job, are better at stakeholder engagement, have an increased sense of well-being, and they produce higher quality work. Unfortunately, the 2023 statistics show that only 1 in 5 U.S. employees say that they have a good friend or a best friend at work. The point is, there is such power in connection and creating environments where people feel like they can be valued and supported. It really is core to who we are. At Ohio State, undergraduates who are part of a student organization are 2.3 times more likely to report feeling that they are a member of the Ohio State community, and 3.4 times more likely to have relationships with other Ohio State students. The annual Student Life Survey also tells us that students who are involved in at least one campus activity are more likely to feel they are a part of the Ohio State community and to generally be satisfied overall with their experience at Ohio State. Next, what you would see if there was a slide, so try to visualize it for yourself. Oh, it's on the screen. Great, as you can see on the screen. That's excellent. Alternatively, you may be surprised to learn that in our most recent results from the 2022 National College Health Assessment, 55% of Ohio State students screened positive on the scale for loneliness. Data from last fall's wellness assessment also found that 44% of undergraduates report they do not have a strong social network. I want to focus on that for just a minute because I think that for many of us, we believe that we are working with and alongside a generation of students that are probably the most well-connected that they've ever been, primarily because of social media. We see students and others walking across campus, and I will raise my hand and say I'm probably one of those people that walks across campus sometimes, taking a peek at my phone, not wholly studying it, but at least looking at it momentarily. We think that that's the way that people are connecting. What the data tells us is that's not what students perceive as a form of connection. They can be in a room with people, be on their phone, and still feel lonely and disconnected. As you can imagine, and as I'm gonna ask Dr. Sharma to talk a little bit about what we know clinically in this space, is that when people don't feel connected or valued or supported, we can see a strong sense of isolation, which can also lead to anxiety and depression and other issues that can plague our community in a way that can impact our students' abilities to be retained and to persist toward graduation. That makes this alone a really important topic for us to think about. In 2023, the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, issued an official advisory that warned about what he calls the public health crisis of loneliness, isolation, and lack of connection in our country. In that report, he shared that having social connections can decrease the risk of developing and worsening heart disease, anxiety, high blood pressure, dementia, depression, and diabetes. I took some time to read Dr. Murphy's book called Together, in which he writes about the importance of human connection and how loneliness is affecting our mental and physical well-being. I'd like to share just a few short excerpts from this book. Quote, when we become chronically lonely, most of us are inclined to withdraw, whether we mean to or not. What often matters is not the quantity or the frequency of social contact, but the quality of our connections and how we feel about them. Being connected to others gives us a stake in more than our own interest. So we want to spend some time today with all of you wanting to think together about hearing those statistics, understanding that for many of you, you have direct relationships and partnerships with our students. Everyone has faculty and staff that they work with or supervise or lead. And when we think about the numbers and the impact of those folks' experiences on how they enjoy their work or enjoy the institution, this is a really important topic. I'll be very candid with you all. When we first got this data around loneliness, it really struck me. And it caused a great deal of concern because there's this idea that students are so well connected and have built strong communities. The data from our students suggest that that's not true. So what's our responsibility as an institution to be able to think more critically about loneliness, how we are helping to facilitate connections, not just coming into a room and receiving information, what are other things that we can do to help our students, our colleagues, really have a stronger connection to the university, to their work, and with each other. So we want to spend just a few minutes really having that sort of facilitated conversation with all of you, both those that are online and those that are physically here and present here today. What I would like to ask very quickly, though, is if Dr. Sharma would mind coming up and sharing things that he's seeing from the Student Life Counseling and Consultation Office, and then also asking Bobby McAlpine to share the perspective from some of our students. Mickey?
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Dr. Shivers. So a few key points I'll share with you. At CCS, so we're the University Student Counseling Center, working with undergrads, grads, professional students. When we look at what we see diagnostically and what comes into our office, anxiety diagnosis would be number one, and depression is number two. You know, she referenced this component of loneliness. There is no diagnosis of loneliness. However, if someone is struggling with loneliness, if struggling with connection, that can lead to symptoms of anxiety and depression. One thing, I'd say a trend we've seen over the last 2 to 3 years, I think this is a post-pandemic component, is transition to campus. The age-old homesickness, which didn't start now, has been around forever, has become more intense. Our first-year students, the largest entering first-year class we've ever had, has had more of a struggle with this transition to campus. I think there's that offshoot of go home, physically distance, wear a mask, be 6 foot apart, go back to school. All of that happening through the high school years, impact relationships, impact connection, transfer over to campus. Most of our students will be able to navigate through that, but some of them, if not getting connected, will struggle with anxiety and depression. Another thing we've noted, if you're struggling with loneliness from a student perspective, we have a lot of organizations, a lot of events, a lot of student clubs on campus, ways for students to get connected and meet people. And that can involve being comfortable with being uncomfortable. You need to go to the student event or the student organization. I don't want to go, I'm going to have to go by myself, I don't know anyone there. You need to go to the student event. So I'm saying it's getting students to feel comfortable with that sense of being uncomfortable or being vulnerable. So I think this is where all of us, students, faculty, staff, can support our students in taking those first couple steps to find ways to get more connected on our campus. I'm teeing it up for you, Bobby. Okay?
See, I did that, right? So just really quickly, just to share, first I want to thank Dr. Shivers for bringing this to the University Senate, and then also, you know, inviting me as a student body president for undergraduates to comment a little bit on this matter. From what we are seeing, and I know that my undergraduate caucus and probably the graduate and professional students as well will probably nod, so many students are feeling this type of loneliness. Like, since the pandemic, since coming back, I know I was class of 2020 from high school. Like, I still, like, there are certain times where I'm like, wow, like, I'm actually in college. Like, this is, it's still weird to me because we didn't get the closure to high school all the way. And then we came to college, and it's like we were kind of starting, but not all the way starting because we were online, but then not, kind of. So it can be weird. So, you know, I believe that higher education is we're at the precipice now of solving, or at least beginning to solve, and I believe Ohio State is well positioned to be a leader in that, solving this problem of loneliness. So for everybody who knows me, they know that I love a great icebreaker, a great activity, things like that. And so we talked a little bit about some questions that we might be able to ask that we would invite all of you to just talk to each other about and to those online, you know, brainstorm about. And then we'll ask you to share out just a little bit. So the first question, so I heard a few years ago that there were some conversations around the topic of academic rigor and how to maintain it while also supporting student mental health at the same time. I believe both things can be the same at the same time. We can have a very academically rigorous university while also taking care of student mental health. So what are some initiative approaches that you have either heard of or you have seen in and outside the classroom at Ohio State that, again, covers that balance between academic rigor and making sure we take mental health seriously? So talk to your neighbor, just, you know, talk a little bit. Yes. We have conversations, there we go.
Oh, thank you, buddy.
Conversation is going on, talking about very, very important issues. So now, in the spirit of University Senate and coming together, you know, as, you know, multiple constituent bodies, we would love for all of you to, not all of you, but most of you, hopefully, at least a few of you, to share out what you were able to talk about with the people next to you and the people you talk to. to share?
I'll share.
Perfect.
Yes. I think my perception of our students is we might be able to kill two birds.
I'm so sorry. Can we get you a mic? Just because I want the people online. I want the people online to be mad at me because this you look very smart. So you're going to say something.
Now.
Oh, with the glasses too.
Just kidding. So I think we can kill two birds with one stone. And here's my observation. Many of our students come to Ohio State and they lack study skills and time management and organizational skills. And so they get in over their heads and they start struggling with how to actually manage the course load because high school and college, university are two different things, right? So here's a suggestion. I don't know if this is feasible. It would require some resources on the part of the university. Take every freshman and give them a short course in time management, study skills, note-taking, things like that. And the way we could kill two birds with one stone is we could make connections with the students. You know, sort of have the students have this experience where they work in teams and they learn those things, I don't know, some social events surrounding that thing, I think that would go a long ways because I teach mostly juniors and seniors and I am shocked at how poorly their social or their study skills have developed or been maintained up until that point. So, friendly suggestion.
No, yeah, so that's very, you know, very much going on the academic route of things, but I do like that. Back in the corner, here we are.
Hi, Bobby.
Hey, what's up?
I would say definitely a very important topic. One thing that we talked about with me working with first year students within our MSP, Moral Scholars Program leadership course that we teach through the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, definitely encouraging collaboration over competition. Because students do come to the collegiate realm and it is a competition. It took a lot for them to get here. And so they have a lot of pressure when they walk into this space. And so being able to definitely encourage collaboration where we are establishing more working groups, we're collaborating more, staff is collaborating with students, where we're able to be able to encourage a space where we're learning from each other. And it also kind of breaks down isolation because we're able to have a social support. So that collaboration piece is key.
I love that. I love that. I think we have some students over here. But just while Caroline is doing that, I also think, you know, something like MSP is something that makes Ohio State smaller. You know, so just building that community and being able to build that culture within those communities is very important. Sorry, go ahead.
Hi, so can we all hear that? Okay, awesome. So Andrad and I both are pretty mad, and we both are in some very hard science courses, which is, you know, it's contributing to the academic rigor at Ohio State. And we discussed how there's a little bit of a disparity in our courses because at first our reaction was like, how are these professors actually helping us? Like, it's all just like tests and exams and that's it. Like, that's what we're graded on. And students feel like they have very little control over their grades when the class is test heavy, and we all don't learn the same way. Like, we're all very like different learners, and there's a lot of courses that are more like discussion based and collaborative, and that's what really like allows people to still be able to get the good grades they want while still understanding the material and performing it and presenting it in the way that works best for them. So I realized that my one professor for biology, which is a very rigorous class, allows us to choose how our tests are performed and whatever. So I was a few minutes late to this class this Senate meeting because I had that bio class and we were taking a quiz and it was a collaborative quiz and he allowed us to choose like from a bunch of options. Like, do we want the test or the quiz to be collaborative or do we want them to be by ourselves? Like, but if it's by ourselves, we get more time, but if it's collaborative, we get less time. If it's open note, it's a little bit less time, but not like too much. I don't know. It was really nice to be able to have that freedom, and he takes the majority vote of the entire class. He also allowed us to choose how our exams are going to be, like whether they're going to be short answers, multiple choice, or like long essays or whatever. And I think it's really nice to allow students to have the freedom of how they want to be graded and how they want to be, I guess, tested and where they want that letter to come from and how they want it to be represented. Anrad and I both have like struggled in a bunch of different science courses where it's like, oh my gosh, I'm just not getting this material, and you can study for hours without it really like counting, because the test is what matters in those courses. So allowing students the freedom to, I guess, choose what they want their education to look like has been really helpful for us.
I love that. I think we have one more student that will move on to the next question.
Thank you very much. So it's no secret that our professors are not mental health professionals. So, you know, when we have this blurb on our syllabus about where we can seek out mental health support, I think that's a great place to start. I really appreciate what she said over there about having that community on campus, having a smaller family within this big crazy world we have here. And I think for most students, for me, example, I transferred school, so I didn't have the opportunity to join a Morrill Scholar or a scholarship program. I find that students who are in those programs are seemingly a lot happier and have better time accessing these resources than other students who are not involved in these programs. And so I look to the role of RAs and the community that these kids have on their floors. I will say I did not enjoy the school that I went to before I came here. There's a reason I transferred, but the school I was at really did it well with their mental health services and the role of their RAs really being a support system, having social events weekly, required monthly meetings one-on-one with our RAs, really investing the RAs' times into their floor students' lives. I think that could be a huge step, and I think it's a resource that's not particularly being used here right now. When I transferred in, I did feel really lonely. I came here knowing no one. I went from a really small school. I came here. I saw my RA once, and that was it. So I think we should really look towards the residence hall communities and how we can better that. I will also say I'm grateful to be in a place now where I have not sought out mental health services here, but when I was at my old school, I really depended on them. They made me feel like they were seeking me out rather than I had to seek out mental health services on my own. And I know that we are in a mental health professional shortage right now, and I'm sure you guys are so busy, but maybe finding a way, an avenue to make that more available to students, email class, like a monthly email class, what's going on here, and I think could be very beneficial. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay, gotcha. Alrighty. So, would either Dr. Shivers or Dr. Sharma, would you all like to give kind of closing remarks? We are out of time, but we do want to just keep this conversation going, so there will be some sort of a survey or something sent out to all senators as well, just talking about your unique challenges that you're facing when it comes to loneliness, mental health, and things. But Dr. Sharma?
There are also good questions in the chat. We will save them for you.
Yeah, a final thought I'd share with you is that I think what we're highlighting here is there's ways in which we can all be supportive of students, make sure we know what the right resources, events, activities are to send them to. The other thing I'd say, last point I'd share with you, is there's this, I really do this connection between loneliness and belonging. That when people don't have a sense of belonging, it leads to a feeling of loneliness. And related to that, when individuals have a sense of belonging, when people feel they have a sense of belonging in a community, they are much less likely to do violence in that community. So having a sense of belonging increases safety for everybody in the community. So there are multiple positive things that come up in this way. And I'm very mindful of things that we talked about, and the president talked about, to open us up today. But like, these are things to keep in mind that are a benefit for everyone.
Thank you all.
So our second discussion focuses on education for citizenship at Ohio State. This includes items related to voting access and voter registration, as well as free assembly and updates to the university space standards. We'll hear presentations from Stacy Rostowskis, Vice President for Government Affairs, Ann Sheeran, Senior Associate General Counsel and Director of Legal Operations, and Strategic Initiatives, and Kelly Urig, Associate Vice President for Operations in the Office of Student Life, who will also present. So I'm going to turn things over to Stacy to get us started.
Well, now for something completely different. Good afternoon. I'm Stacy Ostaskis, the Vice President for Government Affairs, and it's a pleasure to be here. Jared and the committee asked me to come and talk about two things, voter resources and the election. So I don't know if I need to tell you, but I will because I'm counting the days. There are 46 days until Election Day. And there's some great two slides on the screen. So I'm on the first one, or the second one that doesn't have my name on it. Even though that's 46 days away, voting actually begins in 2 weeks. Early voting here in Ohio will start October 8th, and military and overseas voting as well, my slides here, begins October 20th. You can vote by absentee or by mail, as well as early voting on Morris Road. Early voting ends on November the 3rd. That was a request by actually the county boards of elections in Ohio because it takes a while to transition from early in-person voting to election day voting. And then of course, election day is on November the 5th. Our office, along with actually my colleagues up here and many in the room, work very closely with the Franklin County Board of Elections, the Secretary of State's office, and in fact this year, given the heightened interest and that we haven't had sort of a normal in-person voting for our now two presidential cycles, the last one obviously was during COVID, we've had several conversations and meetings with both the Secretary of State's office and the Franklin County Board of Elections to prepare. The number one takeaway regarding voting is for us as a community to partner with and early and often consult with and utilize the great resource that is OSU Votes. And the link to OSU Votes is in on my slides. This is a nonpartisan office within the Office of Student Life. So I want to thank Dr. Shivers, Kristen Rupert Davis, who runs that office, obviously Kelly, works very closely with the two. One of the most important things is for us as we are encouraging people to register to vote to do it in a nonpartisan fashion. And that's why anytime anyone contacts us about voter registration, we encourage them to work with OSU Votes. So one other thing I think I will just point out is that in 2023, the state of Ohio updated its voter identification laws. So this year, this will be the first presidential election with these new voter ID laws. The acceptable forms of ID in Ohio are an Ohio driver's license that is not expired, a U.S. passport, a free state ID that you can get from a bureau from the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. However, utility bills, government issued checks, or other government documents are no longer accepted. So we do have a polling location in the union, and so one of the things that we have worked with the Franklin County Board of Elections is to make sure that the poll workers there know and have some training, knowing that our population is a bit more transient and may have some questions about the ID laws. So moving on to the election, on the slides I highlighted some of the key areas and the key races that we are watching. Obviously, it's a presidential election year. I don't need to tell anybody in this room. I did not put that on there because I really wanted a spotlight on Ohio. I will say, and again, I'm not a prognosticator, but I certainly get asked a lot about what's going to happen. The latest polls that have come out just this past week in Ohio have President Trump up by 8 percentage points, 8 to 10 is what the variable has been over the last couple of weeks. Nationally, it looks to be a very, very tight race with Vice President Harris leading in the national polls. The states to watch are Nevada, Georgia, North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and of course, Pennsylvania. Ohio's not on that list, although Ohio's certainly been in the news for other reasons recently. Moving to Ohio and the races that, again, that I think will obviously have an additional impact on the university. We have a Senate seat. That is the most expensive Senate race in the country this year, with over $350 million being spent on advertising, which is unbelievable to meet Senator Brown, the incumbent, running against Bernie Moreno, the challenger. The latest polling has Senator Brown up by 3%. That's within the margin, but most folks that are watching this think that if President Trump doesn't win by more than 10 points, that it would be a strong showing for Senator Brown to get reelected. Here in Ohio, at the Ohio legislature, as you all may know, Republicans control both the House and the Senate. All 99 Ohio General Assembly seats are in are up for re-election, 67 are Republican, 32 Democrat. It is likely that we'll see some flips in terms of Democrats picking up a couple of seats, but probably not enough to erode the veto-proof majority that is in the House. Same goes for the Senate. There are 17 of the 33 seats up for re-election, 16 Republicans and one Democrat. Same goes in terms of the majority likely to stay Republican. Three Ohio Supreme Court races, all of which are very competitive. And then a couple of ballot initiatives. Again, knowing that we may have folks that are not just in Franklin County, there is statewide issue one, which is the redistricting issue, and then a local initiative that I'll point out for those of us here in Franklin County, the Linkus Transit expansion. So turnout is expected to be high, and that's what's going to drive and be a barrier for those of us that are political scientists and everybody that's interested. What will be really interesting to watch. And I will say the Office of Government Affairs is already hard at work looking at what all of the scenarios could be as we look past November 5th. There is going to be change, even if there is not a political party change in the administration. Having Vice President Harris and Governor Walz assume a leadership will mean changeover in cabinet seats and beyond. We could also see a flip in the House and the Senate. The other ways that they are now, we'll see. And here in Ohio, we'll also have changes, even though the parties won't remain in control, likely. We will have a new Senate president. Senate President Huffman is term limited from the Senate. He's running for the House. So it is expected that Senator Rob McCauley is going to ascend to become the next Senate president. He's an Ohio State alumnus. And then over in the House, Senate President Huffman has announced that he is going to likely challenge Speaker Stevens. For that leadership race. So, like I said, it's going to be a busy few months, certainly a busy holiday season as we're working through what all the changes are in November. So, that's my report.
Thanks, Stacey, and thank you all for having us today. As the agenda shows, Anne and I are here to give you an overview of the updated space standards. And first, we'll share a bit of information about the preparatory work that took place over the summer. As Stacey just shared about the upcoming election and with the increase in demonstration activity on campus and really across the nation, a series of work streams prepared for the year with a comprehensive effort to clarify policies and procedures, improve educational and support resources, and promote democratic engagement, as Stacey talked about as well. On your screens, you will see six work streams and the key units that serve as leaders for those. And there were certainly a host of other units from across campus who provided feedback and also participated on the various work streams. One of the important pieces of our work was to try to knit together all of the various policies and procedures and guidelines and standards, because we were receiving some feedback that sometimes it's really hard to know what goes together. Because there are so many elements involved, part of our efforts over the summer were to ensure the complementary materials more clearly established these connections, as well as to ensure that the relevant websites are consistent, comprehensive, and easy to use. Today, we'll be talking with you more specifically about the space rules and the work stream that focused on that.
Thanks, Kelly. Next slide, please. So I'm going to start with kind of a quick overview just of where we are as a university and kind of the laws that apply, because they're important in this space. And so the First Amendment applies to the university as a public university, and that means that the university can make rules for our spaces and how they're used. The important thing to note here for our outdoor spaces is that they're under the law considered open forums. That was a change made to Ohio law about 3 years ago. And what that means from a practical standpoint is that the university can make rules about the time, place, and manner of the use of our spaces as long as they're content neutral and consistently enforced. And for almost at least 26 years, or as far back as I can find, the university has done that through our university space rules. Next slide, please. So to kind of back up a little bit, since at least October of 1998, the university has had rules in place governing how our outdoor spaces, there we go, are used. Those rules have been revised multiple times since 1998, and including in the summer of 2016, in which the rules were revised to the current format that you see today. In part, the rules were revised because we were looking to align them with current practice. So, for example, if you look at the slides, have the 1998 rules. There's a line in there about how big your signage can be on the oval when you have it outside. Not too surprisingly, we did bring rulers with us to check the size of those signs. And so one of the things we did in 2016 was really try to bring those rules into alignment with the things that we were doing. Since 2016, the rules are reviewed every 4 years. That work usually happens in the summer. We last took a look at them in 2020. There was already plans in place to review those rules this summer, and that work was folded into the work of the campus activism and election preparedness work group. So we became a work stream through that work that was happening this summer. Hand it off to Kevin.
So if you're looking at the slides, you can see the list of units that were represented on that work stream. And for the most part, our historian here is able to tell us that that group has remained pretty consistent over the last 8 years, although we did add representation from Faculty Council and University Senate this year. Additionally, we also solicited feedback from various university entities that regularly use the space standards in their normal course of business, and others who have special expertise that was helpful to the review process. Before finalizing and submitting for final approval, the material was shared with student government leaders for their review. Thank you for your time.
Oh, wow. Anna's gonna. We'll talk about the changes as well. I know, right? Now I'm gonna talk a little bit about the changes that were made to the rules over the summer. So the first thing is that the name was updated to University Space Standards. I keep referring to it as rules. I'm trying to break that habit. I know Sarah's waving her finger at me. But we updated the name to University Space Standards. Kim Potter from Compliance reached out to us about the governing. How governing documents are named at the university, and we worked with her to make sure that the document was entitled the right way. So, though they've been called rules all the way back to at least 1998, we updated that to be space standards this year. We also added a definition section. This was something that previously, if you looked at the last version from 2020, there were definitions, but they were actually embedded in the document. Which, as we had conversations, made it really hard if you were using the document to try to figure out what kind of rules apply to your reservation, what definitions apply. So we worked to make a separate definition section that's now standalone, so that can be referenced as you look through the rest of the document. So when space reservations are made, the definitions that we're talking about are referenced in one place versus needing to flip to a specific section to figure out where we define it. Two specific definitions I'll just call attention to. First, we defined event. And in the section below the definitions, we provide information about what it means for an event to need a reservation. That means, and we define that as expecting sole usage of the space, requiring or expecting university staffing to support the event, or having a physical setup, so like a table, a sign. Those activities require a reservation through our standard reservation process, and that's consistent with how we've defined reservation for the most part. I'll touch on another piece in just a minute, since I've been looking at these rules since 2016. We also added a definition of restricted noise. Again, going back to 1998, amplified sound had been something that had been prohibited on campus, and we very frequently heard, what is amplified sound? What qualifies as amplified sound? And so our committee spent a lot of time thinking through, how do we define an appropriate definition? So what we did was add a definition of what amplified sound is with examples. We referenced an existing university disruption rule that's been in place since 1986. And then we also note that there are certain times on campus where noise is restricted because it's classes are happening, university offices are holding meetings, and students live on campus, right? A lot of our outdoor spaces are outside those residence halls. So making clear that when noise is restricted is also, if noise is happening during that time, it's considered restricted noise. There is an exception process for anybody who wants to use amplified sound or otherwise use restricted noise during those time frames or during those time periods, and that's something that is embedded in the event reservation process. You can request an exemption, and those go through the standard review like any other request for an event. So the one note I mentioned about the definition of event, we did remove an 100-person requirement that had previously been there. As you can imagine, doing a headcount at events is challenging. And so part of our work as we look at these rules every 4 years is to determine, are there anything in the rules that we can't enforce? And if that's the case, it needs to be taken out. So that that part of the definition was removed for this year. We also added a closing time for outdoor spaces. All of our buildings on campus have closing times. I think we were actually a little bit surprised when we looked to see that outdoor spaces didn't have a closing time listed. That's probably because when you make a reservation for outdoor space, because of the amplified noise restricted, like when the time ends for being able to use amplified noise, that was really when most events ended. So we clarified that that time is 10 p.m. Similar to the sound requirements, there's an exception process for those that want to have events that go later than 10 p.m. or overnight events. Again, all of those exceptions and processes have been in the rules since at least 2012. We just moved them into one place to make it more clear this year. And then last but not least, we made a lot of revisions for readability and clarity, including aligning the introduction of the rules to a lot of the language that we use in other places around freedom of expression. And I give huge credit to Sarah, who undertook a lot of that work with our team to really make sure that as we talk about the rules, they aren't standalone, right? They take into consideration everything else that applies. We also started cross-referencing those rules and policies. Again, this previously really functioned a little bit like a standalone document, and we wanted to account for the fact that we have a lot of rules, policies, and other processes that should be cross-referenced for ease of use. And then last but not least, we structured it in a more reader-friendly manner, trying to understand that these rules apply when reservations are made, and in order to understand them, we wanted to make sure that they were readable, and that was one of, I think, the challenges in particular when we started this process earlier this year. So with that, I will hand it off to Kelly.
So as I mentioned at the beginning of our time together, helping the community have a clear understanding of where they can go for information was critically important. In compliance with Senate Bill 40, which was effective in summer of 2021, Ohio State had already created a Freedom of Expression website. So this summer gave us an opportunity to go back and review that website to update it so that content is accessible, user-friendly, and comprehensive. If you've taken a look at the site, you might have seen some changes like updated navigation titles, updates to the content to make it universally consistent, increased educational content about the First Amendment, including a fantastic frequently asked questions section, updates to the resources, support, and policy listings, and last but certainly not least, links to the various pages of the new Listen, Learn, Discuss platform's website, which I encourage you all to check out. We hope this information has been helpful, and we thank you for giving us the time to be with you today.
Okay, at this time, Carolyn Clark will move the microphone. Anybody has any questions or comments?
Off the bat, I have one from the Zoom, which is a question of whether you can share the slides. Can we share these slides?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, please do. Yeah.
One down.
Yeah.
With so much importance on connection at Ohio State, as loneliness is detrimental to student well-being, what do you think about students who are unable to connect with faculty, staff, or other students due to increased hostility toward Muslim, Arab, or Palestinian students on campus?
I appreciate the question, but we're actually here to talk about the space rules, so I don't know that we're prepared to answer that specific question today. But thank you for it.
Okay.
Okay, this is about the space rules here. And I draw your attention to, I don't see a page number, but it's like paragraph F and items 2, 9, and 12. And I'll be brief here as I possibly can. In item 2, it says, other than university department or use of written permission from student life, events, and conferences, usage of university space is limited to the designated hours of operation for the space and other property. I teach in the Fisher College of Business. Friday, the building closes at 5, and then it's closed over the weekend. We have faculty coming in and working. So, to me, this is unclear when you say department use.
So you have access to the building, correct?
Access to, but I'm looking at a rule right now, and it doesn't say except for those who have access to the building. It doesn't say department affiliated. It doesn't say faculty affiliated. I can imagine that the department could be defined quite restrictively, and so I'm concerned. And I think a common sense reading of this would allow the faculty that I know who come in over the weekend to do their work.
Certainly,
but I'm,
absolutely.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is, could you be clear about that? And could you put that in the definition section? Or maybe we could even have a comment section after these rules to simply explain what the intent of the rule would be for people who might look at rules and think, well, what if they don't like this faculty member and they apply the rule to that person?
Sure, so I guess we had assumed that departmental use would include faculty use of
you
their
get the
office
point.
Spaces.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying it should be in the rules somewhere.
Okay.
These rules are very specific, and I appreciate all the hard work that goes into it. I'm just suggesting that there could be a little more work, okay? So moving on, let's look at number 9. And my question there is, if you have something on a bulletin board, if I put an AAUP poster on my bulletin board,
yep.
Is that a problem?
So it's going to depend on what kind of forum the bulletin board is. So these rules are about outdoor space, so it's important to note that we have lots of spaces around the university. So for example, bulletin boards in buildings are different, and they their usage depends on how they're typically used. So if you have a bulletin board in your building, for example, that is used to post anything, if I can post about my guitar lessons, if you can post any notices that you want, we've created an open forum on that bulletin board, and signage can and is posted on there, and the university won't remove it. If, for example, the bulletin board is designated like for departmental business, and the only thing that I can post is about staff meetings or other departmental notices, if I post my notice about my guitar lessons, that signage can be taken down. So it's a little bit different from what you're talking about here. This is really about signage outdoors. There's also signage standards that the university has that are kept by the FOD. But what you're talking about is actually a little bit different and more nuanced, and really depends on how that bulletin board space is treated and used.
I didn't see anything in here about outdoor use in paragraph 9. I might have been mistaken. It says no bills, signs, or banners may be attached, affixed, or projected to university furniture.
Sure. I'd recommend taking a look at the signage standards that are linked there.
Okay.
They address bulletin boards.
Well, thank you. I see that there's a linkage there. But maybe we could be a little clearer about this and put a comment. And my last comment is with regard to paragraph 12, number 12. I think you have a content problem here. It says events consistent with the university's teaching, research, and service missions requested to end after 9 p.m. must not have outside or inside habitation be the primary focus of the event. Now, I'm old enough to remember the first Earth Day and the teach-ins that we had, and you could go you could have a group of people, students, perhaps, and others that would go out after 10 p.m. to talk about climate change and focus on habitation. It's not, what do you mean primary focus?
So the primary focus is to like habitate a space. Again, this is not new.
Well,
this
why don't you say that? Because we could talk about, we could talk about habitation
point of
space.
Order. Yeah. Point of order, since when can we ask multiple questions and take up this amount of time?
Sorry, I will stop. I'll shut up now.
Thank you.
Hi. Just real quick, how are we working to communicate to students and faculty that Election Day is remote?
So Election Day is asynchronous, so which may also mean remote, but I know that there has been a number of communications that have gone out from the provost's office and from the provost, and I'm guessing that there will be more as we get closer to Election Day. So appreciate the question. Obviously, that helps us know that we need to perhaps publicize that more. So, yeah, thanks.
Hi, this is my first Senate session, so bear with me. I'm honored to be here among so many diverse backgrounds and voices. Before posing my question, I would like to give a little bit of context. So on April 25th, 2024, after months of closed-door meetings with OSU administration leading to no formidable action, Students for Justice in Palestine and anti-genocide activists set up a Gaza solidarity encampment on the South Oval to demand OSU divest from entities complicit in the ongoing Israeli genocide and occupation of Palestine. With now 347 days of ongoing genocide where over 186,000 Palestinians have been massacred, this tragedy should resonate deeply with us as every university in Gaza has been decimated, leaving 625,000 students without education. Instead of engaging with these legitimate demands at that time, OSU administration responded with shocking brutality against their own students that were participating in a form of nonviolent demonstration. They deployed OSU PD state troopers in riot gear armed with rubber bullets, stationed snipers on the rooftop of our student union, conducted drone surveillance, and executed violent and unconstitutional arrests. In the aftermath of April 25th's events, OSU graduate students and faculty issued respective powerful statements condemning the brutal actions taken against peaceful demonstrators and reaffirmed the encampment's demands. Following these grievances, OSU administration has instead doubled down with these repressive student code of conduct policies, adversely harming students that they are quote unquote claiming to protect. For example, the updated university space standards heavily restrict the ability for students to peacefully protest. Megaphones, as you guys stated, and other forms of amplified sound are no longer acceptable in indoor spaces, which has historically been the center of student-led movements such as the Ohio Union. If our university mission includes fostering students who are educated and engaged citizens, these restrictions are abhorrent contradictions that run counter to the very missions and values that we took time today to speak about, such as free speech that this university claims to uphold. So regarding the aforementioned, how do the revisions of the space standards reflect the statements released by CGS and faculty, as well as support the safety of students exercising their rights to freedom of expression? And how will these rules be reflected during the university conduct board meetings for the students arrested in April and going forward?
Sure, so I'll start. We can't speak to the student conduct process. I'm not part of those boards. I'm not part of the Office of Student Conduct. So that's really not a question for anybody who's up here today. I don't have the benefit of having either the faculty or the CGS statements in front of me in this moment, but I will say as part of the normal process, We had a lot of conversation around places for clarification, was the naming of the document, other things to clarify the rules and how they're used for everybody. They apply to across the board uses of our spaces. And so, again, without the benefit of having that information in front of me, I don't think I can unfortunately answer your specific questions here, but I can tell you that we sought feedback. Our committee included members from University Senate, from Faculty Council. We solicited feedback from student government leaders before finalizing the rules in an effort to solicit that feedback to ensure that the rules reflected concerns of the community.
Hi, thanks very much for coming and talking. Susan Paul, I'm a faculty senator. My question has two parts. One is which it had been discussed last year that it might be appropriate for these space standards to be part of a big P policy that lived at the policy page. And so I'd be interested to know what the thought was in maintaining the standards instead of the policy. And given that many people go to that policy page to find things like this, what is being done to make sure that these standards are accessible and that people who are looking for this information can find this information?
Sure, so a couple of things. So determination on whether or not something is policy was not the purpose of the group. It was to revise the existing rules and standards, which is what the document was and has been. As it relates to policies, these are now cross-referenced in a number of policies. That was part of the work that Kim Potter helped us do this summer, as far as amplifying where we are pulling in other policies, making sure that this is referenced, the document references other documents, as well as is on the Freedom of Expression website. That's helpful. The feedback on not being on the policy website is helpful. I'd want to talk with Kim, who owns that website, to figure out how we reference other university guidance, like standards and other things, to figure out if there's a broader piece and fix we can do there, because certainly the purpose and intent of this is for our community and others to be able to find them so that they can review them and ask questions. And so they're on the Freedom of Expression website, which they used to be buried on an FOD website years ago. So, but happy to have that conversation.
I think it's just that if I were doing something that wasn't freedom of possession, I might not look at that page.
No, I think that's a great standards. I think it's a great point, Susan, or something I'm happy to take back to talk with him about. Absolutely.
Colleague across the way there posed the question, how do you believe that the updates to the standard reflect the feedback received from the Faculty Council and the other groups? As Susan pointed out, one of our primary points of feedback was that it should be transitioned to a policy. So I'll ask this question. Do you believe that the process that was undergone over the summer is effective at ensuring that there is adequate community voice around this policy, this standard, given its broad impact to the community?
Sure. So again, we followed the same processes that we've been following for the last 8 years in the review this summer. This is the appropriate review process for standards, and the determination of whether or not these should be pivoted to a policy is certainly not my decision. So. Again, happy to take that feedback back. I'm going to be talking with Kim anyway about the policy website, so happy to talk with her. Thanks.
I do see more questions, but we are at 5 o'clock, and that's the limit we had for the meeting today. So I am going to turn it back over to President Carter.
All right. Thank you, everyone. I want to take a minute to just say how much I appreciate our presenters for joining us this afternoon and sharing their expertise and perspective with us. I also want to thank all the members who participated in these discussions. One of the great things about our University Senate, and it's a forum for ideas and debate, as much as it's a way to help govern this complex institution. With that, is there any old business? Any new business? Are there any announcements? This concludes the business of the University Senate. The next Senate meeting will take place in this room in a hybrid format on Thursday, October 31st, 2024. This meeting is adjourned.